The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 102. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's kind of like our Rebel Capitalist Show official bear on the dollar. He and Lynn Alden. So he needs no introduction. His name is Luke Groman. Luke, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on, George. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to talk to you. When I was writing out some of the questions for today's conversation, I was like, oh, these are some good ones. There's so much going on right now. I want to kind of go back quickly to the recent interview you had with Grant Williams on the Investors Podcast with Stig and Preston. It was absolutely fabulous. That was one of your best, I think.
Thank you.
You talked about the TGA, and since that time, I kind of borrowed that from you. I've used it in some whiteboard videos. But if you could go over your thinking right now, when you look at the TGA, a potential second wave of the virus, and then this maybe an additional stimulus package, I don't know how that ties into the TGA, going into the election.
Sure. So, big picture, something we wrote about a little over a month ago to our subscribers was a chart that Chris Cole highlighted on Twitter, citing data from Lacey Hunt at Hoisington, and it was net savings as a percent of gross national income. And it showed that, and it's effectively a measure of private balance sheet capacity.
Right.
And it went negative only two times in history. During the Great Depression, so call it 1930 to 32, it went negative briefly in 2008. And then it has gone more negative than it has ever been in the first half of this year. And a lot of people read that as, okay, it's another Great Depression, another big deflationary wave. And that's our read on it was a little different, which is that's one possible read on all of this, is that you could get another big deflationary wave. We wrote when we wrote this report, like I said, about 5-6 weeks ago. The other, basically, once you're in that position, there's two outcomes. It's the system either collapses chaotically, particularly given the debt and financing needs that the United States specifically, but sovereigns and corporates, et cetera, globally need. There's no private balance sheet capacity in the United States to finance U.S. deficits, corporate bonds. And so basically, option one is a disorderly unwind of record levels of debt. Option number two is basically this chart is telling us the Fed's now in for a penny, in for a pound. They will buy treasuries, corporates, used baseball cards, gum that you took off the bottom of a desk in seventh grade and kept because some girl you liked, had put it there, whatever. But in all seriousness, so there's this very binary read of context. And so when to tie that back to your question of the COVID, is there a second wave? And then this TGA account. So the TGA Treasury General account is basically the Treasury's checking account with the Fed. And historically has been very closely correlated with the dollar over the last 7 years in particular. In other words, when the TGA is rising, when the balance in the TGA is rising, the Treasury is effectively sucking liquidity out of the system, and it's been supportive of the dollar as measured by the DXY.
Luke, just to be clear, when you're talking about sucking liquidity out of the system, you're talking about bank reserves coming in. So it's like reverse QE. It's like quantitative tightening.
Effectively, yes. There's a tightening of liquidity. Exactly. And so historically, when TGA balances have been rising, it's been supportive of the dollar as measured by DXY and vice versa. When TGA is falling, it's put pressure on the dollar. And what's something we've observed has been this basically that the dollar is, we've been surprised that the dollar has been on one hand, as strong as it's been with the Fed doing what they've done at first, and then surprised that the dollar's been weak as it's been, as the Fed has reduced liquidity reduced their balance sheet growth, and then outright over the last 3 weeks, reduced their balance sheet outright.
Right.
All of those things should be good for the dollar, and it's really not done much. And with that happening at the same time that the TGA has now gone up to nearly $1.7 trillion or $1.8 trillion, I believe, as of last week, it's absolutely unprecedented in terms of the amount of money that is being pulled out of the system by this TGA in theory. And so just by way of context, I think the highest number the TGA had reached in the post-2013 timeframe before this spike, I think, was in the $350 to $400 billion range. So we're now looking at 4 to 5X the amount it's ever been before.
And even take it back before 2008.
Yeah, it was they never really used it. It was de minimis.
I've seen it. It ranges between 2 and 5 billion with a B.
So that was a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've got this situation. So the big picture context where we've got this net savings as a percent of gross national income is telling us one of two things is going to happen. Either the system's going to collapse chaotically without more liquidity, or the Fed's going to have to do an awful lot for an extended period of time. You've got the TGA that is withdrawing liquidity. You've got the Fed now actually shrinking their balance sheet for 3 straight weeks, which is pulling out liquidity. And the dollar's not really responding. And into all of this, to the second part of your question, you have this, in theory, the second wave that appears to be building, at least in terms of positive tests and infections, if not deaths yet. And so for me, as I think about all of this, it's a pretty toxic brew in terms of being supportive for the dollar. All else equal, another wave of COVID, the TGA growing higher, the Fed shrinking their balance sheet, all of these things should be screaming the dollar higher and weighing on risk assets. And the dollar's doing nothing, best case, and risk assets are screaming higher. And so it's been a bit of a head scratcher for me in terms of where this incremental source of liquidity or velocity, it must be velocity driven, because I don't know where the incremental source of liquidity is really coming from at this point. But as far as where things go from here, I think it's very dependent on, does the second wave of infections turn into a second wave of death, of deaths? And if they do, and we have to start shutting down the economy, again, I go back to that net savings as a percent of gross national income. If we have another second wave of deaths and this thing gets bad again and they shut down the economy, there's really two outcomes. Either the system collapses chaotically, and when I say collapses chaotically, corporate debt defaults, sovereign debt defaults, basically everything but the dollar does well. Gold will do well at first. It'll probably get sold off a little bit, like we saw in March, but ultimately gold outperformed pretty much everything other than the dollar. And that basically continues until you start having sovereign bond failure, bond auction failures all over the world, sort of all the worst parts of financial Armageddon. Or a second wave forces the Fed to say, oops, you know what, we're going to go back to that $100 billion a day, and we're not just going to buy treasuries and corporates and junk, but now we're going to buy foreign corporates, which they're doing a little bit on the margin, but we're really going to get after it. And we're also going to buy foreign sovereigns, and the balance sheet reaccelerates higher. And
do you think they'll buy equities?
They could. I think that's a charter change is what I'm told. But ultimately, in my view, I think there are ways around it where if you're affecting the price of high yield credit, you're effectively buying equities as it is. And so they might not ever even need to explicitly or overtly do that. But I wouldn't say it's off the table if that's what needs to happen. And so that gets into this very paradox, this paradox where if things get really bad again with COVID, to me, you could actually see equity markets. I personally think they'll get a bit of a pause, and I want to buy that pause. That's our base case. But I would fully concede that I think the second most likely option is you don't even get a pullback on another rise in COVID. You simply they just take off. You basically would start to see asset price hyperinflation in the United States, basically the Venezuelization of U.S. markets, where unemployment rises, the GDP falls rapidly, and the equity prices just start going asymptotic on expectation of the Fed basically having to buy everything that's not bolted down.
Brings me to this video I'm working on for tomorrow, where I'm trying to think through if it's realistic or what the probabilities are of us to see a headline in the future, whether that's 6 months, a year, I don't know, where we see Dow 30,000, while at the same time we see the unemployment rate, U6, at 30%. What do you think? Is that possible? Am I crazy? Is that tinfoil hat? And if you do think it's possible, how would we get there?
I don't think it's tinfoil hat. I don't think it's crazy. I think if we get a second wave, I think it would be a base case after a bit of a pullback. You get Dow 27,000 to 25,000, and then in a big hurry, you go 25,000 to 30,000 as the Fed's balance sheet goes from 7 trillion and change to 15 trillion over a 3 month period of time, 4 month period of time, And so I think that is some, like I said, some combination. Our base case is that you get a bit of a pullback if you do get a second wave, particularly of deaths, either this summer or in the fall, as many people think will happen, just using the 1918 flu analog. But that's a pullback I want to buy because of all the reasons we've laid out before, where the financialization of the U.S. equity markets effectively are the economy, et cetera, there is simply no ability to let equities sell off too far before it begins to threaten really U.S. national security. And when I say that, basically threaten the ability for the U.S. to place treasury bonds at a politically expedient price. And so, I think that's exactly what you could see. If things get worse again, you're just going to see the Fed sort of, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And you could see that them get more aggressive with Main Street lending. There's a lot of ways they can get the money into the economy, particularly if they're married to the Fed. And I think that the mythical separation of state between the church and state, between the Fed and Treasury, that existed in parts of time over the last several decades, I think that all but got removed in March and in April with some of the things that were done. And so I think that's really how you get to that type of scenario, which really is. It would be a Venezuelization of markets in the U.S. economy, where unemployment could be absolutely 30%. Stocks could be at 30,000 and people are sitting at home collecting $2,000 a month for doing nothing.
What I see when I look at how much are the statistics for, I might be misquoting this. I'm going back to an earlier video I did where I looked at some headlines from CNBC and some data points they had. But when you look at the people who received stimulus checks that are between, I think it was like 30,000 in income and like 70,000 in income, 90% of them used a portion of their stimulus or their additional unemployment to go into the market and buy stocks.
Is that right?
It was something like that. Wow. Yeah. And so it was just a huge percentage of people that either opened up new Robinhood accounts, something like that. So I think that was, call it, what was it, $3 trillion, the stimulus. And if the market goes down, then we get another second wave, and then potentially the death rate increases. All these people are screaming for it. You're going into an election as well. Let's not forget that. So obviously Trump is sitting there thinking he wants to spend as much as possible to buy as many votes. So I just see that maybe a $6 trillion stimulus package. And if people think that the market's just going to go up because there's this Fed put and they're playing with the house's money, and now they're getting $2,000 a month in UBI. I saw other news articles stating that there was proposals for people to get actual bonuses to go back to work. That's how many people don't want to go back to work, and that they have to actually incentivize them. So all of that, I see it kind of playing into the market potentially going higher. One thing I want to clarify, though, Luke, what is your time frame when you advise clients or people who read your research? Because when you're saying if it goes down to 25,000, you're saying, you know, I would buy that because the market could rocket higher. Where someone like me that has a time horizon of like 10 years, my mentality is I'm just going to buy something just because I think it's cheap. Yeah, I could think that it's going up in the next 6 months or going down in the next 6 months. It really doesn't play into my, I like to think about it because it's a lot of fun, but I don't let it play into my strategy for investments. And I think people get very confused. They think that, oh my gosh, Luke thinks the market's going to the moon, and they just assume that you think it's going to the moon in a straight line from here to infinity. And I think time frame is so crucial.
I think that's right. Yeah, we try to highlight when things tactically either seem stretched or seem crazy on the upside or vice versa on the downside. We really try to stay with the main thrust of what we write and what we talk about with clients, really try to be structural over the next 3, 6, 12, 24 month time horizon in terms of this stuff, and really try to highlight, here's what's happening, and highlight, I think, too, that the from a very game theoric type of perspective, sort of how I laid out before with the net savings as a percent of gross national income. We know that this is negative for only the third time in 100 years. We know the prior two times were in basically what were Great Depressions. This is actually worse than either one of those readings. And in both of those prior cases, the dollar got devalued massively, was the way out of it. The dollar was devalued 75% in 33 against gold, and it was devalued effectively against equities and gold and basically at all assets in 08. The Fed's balance sheet went from $800 billion to $4.5 trillion over the next four or five years, and gold tripled and stocks more than tripled since. But gold outperformed stocks for the first 3 years after that period of time was had. And so we just try to lay out this game theoric views of, look, okay, here's a fact. And if we have fact A, fact B, fact C, we can arrange these facts and we can say, okay, here's our potential range of outcomes. And we always try to frame that as here's the range of outcomes. Here's what we think is most likely. Here's our view. But here are some of the other outcomes that could happen, whether they be tails or whatever, to just, because our view is we don't want to tell people what to do. We want to help people learn how to think and how to process what's happening, because what's really happening is not historically unique, but it's unique from the standpoint of most people's lives. This hasn't happened in the West in 100 years. And so if you're not reading history books and trying to take some of those analogs and bring them forward and adjusting those analogs for today's realities of technology, demographics, entitlements, options, derivatives, et cetera, it's an imperfect way to go, but it's the least imperfect way to go, I would say, in terms of really trying to help clients best position for what could happen over the next, you know, the very near term, but then also over the next 6, 12, 24 month timeframe.
You talked about China before, and I know you do a lot of work on how reliant we are on China from a military standpoint. I know a lot of people don't like to think about that, but I know they make a lot of our supplies that our military uses, and then we rely on them to buy bonds. So could you dive into that a little bit? And then also, one of the pushbacks that I always hear from people that say, oh, the U.S. will never lose reserve currency status is because, well, we just have the biggest military. And we can go in there and say, well, you have to use the dollar, or we're going to come in with our tanks and submarines and aircraft carriers and just, you know, take you out. Where that might work with Iraq. I don't know if that would work with China, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. So the really two parts to that. The first is the supply chain side and just the mutual dependence. And it's across supply chains, it's across the financial side, So when you look at the supply chain side, there was a report by the Department of Defense. So the unclassified version of it was released in, I think, September or October of 2018. And it just looked at supply chain vulnerabilities. And this was something that they were talking about 10 years prior in a couple different books I'd read. And it just lays out in stark, I think the report's 150 pages, so the unclassified version, and it looks at how many different single source or dual source or financially troubled suppliers to the U.S. military, how much they're dependent on China within the semiconductor and rare earth supply chain. And that's just on the military side. COVID has highlighted all over again the civilian side, because if you really want to go to war with someone, it's everything's fair game. And so when you saw headlines back in March where 80, 90% plus of our pharmaceutical supply chain at some point touches China, the amount of antibiotics either sourced or where one part of that supply chain touches China was in the 80 to 90% range. And that's important because everybody wants to look at the gross number, but in these situations, you can't look at the gross number coming from China. You have to look at the overall supply chain and apply Liebig's law of the minimum, which is you can't produce this if you're missing one component. And so it's not the full supply chain that matters. It's what percentage of it is touching your potential adversary. And so if people say, well, we'll just go to war and beat them up with the military, you could see where they'd say, okay, the supply of antibiotics stops today. And at that point, all surgeries in the U.S. are in trouble until we can find alternative solutions. You could easily see millions of Americans die of infections that are relatively routine, you know, problems that can be solved with antibiotics. Ditto on the supply chain, to the extent you have a bunch of, you know, 25% of Americans, some big percent of Americans are on antidepressants. It's not advised that you go off antidepressants very rapidly. If those supply chains come off, there would probably be a rash of suicides and mental health issues in the United States. And so there's these complex supply chain issues that we've allowed to develop over the last 20, 30 years, both on the military side and on the civilian side, that is starting to be seen as problematic. And they're moving away from that. And I think we'll see that phase out over time. Financial side, you brought up the treasury bonds, and while the Chinese don't own many treasury bonds anymore, they do own a lot of U.S. dollar assets. And you can, there was a great analysis. There's somebody who blogs Deep Throat IPO at Deep Throat IPO on Twitter. We've talked before, and one of the pieces he highlighted that I thought was so well thought out, it really frames it, is he said, okay, let's just keep the math simple. The U.S. equity total market cap, I don't know where it is today. Equity market cap is, I don't know, 30% or $30 trillion, $35 trillion. It's 160% of GDP, right? Yeah, so say it's $32 trillion, $33 trillion. So now let's go back and say, on average, China has run, again, just to keep the math simple, $400 billion surpluses with the United States over the past 20 years. And that's probably elevated. Even make it simpler. Let's just say it's $300 billion over the past 20 years. So $300 billion times 20 years is $6 trillion. Let's assume they make a modest 5% a year return on those dollars, where much of which are reinvested into U.S. equity markets. And his math, you quickly get to, you compound 5% over 20 years. Rule of 72 is going to be, you're going to double that in less than every 15 years. So you're probably looking at 15 trillion, right? So 6 to 12, a little bit more. You're probably easily somewhere in the $15 to $16 trillion range in terms of total Chinese asset ownership around the world in dollar terms, using some pretty conservative assumptions. Now, relative to that $32 trillion in total U.S. equity market cap, that's a statistically significant percentage. And this then ties back to what I've referred to on Twitter in a couple different discussions as economic mutually assured destruction. So back when the U.S. and USSR had their Cold War, there was the nuclear mutually assured destruction, or nuclear MAD, which was basically if we went to war, we'd blow each other up 16 times over with nuclear missiles, and that would be that. There's this economic MAD mutually assured destruction component here now, because yes, China's short dollars, but they probably have $10, $12, $15, $20 trillion in dollar-denominated assets away from what they own in treasuries that they can sell aggressively to get dollars if they need to, which is a problem because, as we've discussed before, if equities fall, U.S. GDP falls, U.S. tax receipts fall, U.S. consumption falls, and with our debt, you can't have GDP fall without going into a debt death spiral. And basically, the Fed has to come in and bail that out. And so the strong dollar is a weapon we can use against China only until they start saying, they show up and say, hey, I got $15 trillion in equities for sale, want to be done by the end of the week. And then all of a sudden, every bid in the market gets pulled. And either the Fed comes in and says, don't worry, we'll bid for everything, or the market goes to zero and China's in trouble with the strong dollar and the United States starts having failed treasury auctions and you know, the U.S. economy collapses and then the Chinese economy collapses. So there's this economic mutually assured destruction side that very few people consider when they look back and really think about what $300 billion per year in surpluses that China has run against the U.S. over 20 years with some modest amount of asset compounding in that time really means. And so that's what I would say about the supply chain side from both the defense, civilian, and financial. Now, you talk about the other answer is I think a little simpler is, yeah, we have the biggest military. The United, to your point, the United States has never attacked a nuclear armed power. It's never happened.
Right.
And when you look at what China appears to be doing, it looks very much to be trying to make things very expensive. I think they know they can't beat us overall in a war, but the U.S. military, RAND, the RAND Corporation, you know, the defense consultants, they've war gamed this over and over. And there are parts of the world that the U.S. would, you know, whereas 10 years ago, we would still win in the South China Sea. You start looking at those war games, what's been released publicly, a lot of times it's a draw or a loss. And you can see at the very least what China has done strategically is, you know, we have a $10 billion aircraft carrier and they invest in $1,000 million hypersonic nuclear carrier killer missiles. And so effectively they need one $1 million missile to hit to destroy a $10 billion carrier, which is loaded with, you know, however many billions of dollars of aircraft mass. And that's not likely to happen because that would really, things would probably go nuclear very fast. But I think the answer to your question is when you're talking about a country who has a lot that A is nuclear armed, we've never invaded nuclear armed, but even then, what are we going to do? Are we going to bomb the Apple factories? We can hit that target and that target, but don't hit all the American corporate property that's backing the value of these assets. So it's much more of a Mexican standoff than a lot of commentators that tend to be very, there's a lot of bravado sometimes in these conversations, but when you talk to people offline where there's a little bit more analytical side, when you talk about defense people, strategic people, they will tell you, yeah, there's puts and takes here, and it's not as clean cut as, hey, we've got the biggest military, you know, hoo-ah.
That makes a lot of sense. So going back just really quickly to the supply chains, how long do you think it would take to bring those supply chains back to the United States? And how inflationary do you think that would be? Because a lot of people, they beckon back to World War II and say, well, look at World War II. I mean, we just instantly made everything that we needed, like overnight. And I say, well, I don't know if that's as realistic now as it was back then. Just to clarify for the viewers, when I mean inflation, I'm just talking about consumer prices. Because a lot of people just lump it together with the DXY and everything else, just consumer prices domestically.
I think it's a great point. I think it's underappreciated where we are structurally in this whole thing. I think there's a lot of deflationary pressures with debt and with demographics and with technology, and those are separate discussions. But something that I don't think is getting enough airtime in terms of inflationary pressures is we're getting a lot of discussion about deglobalization. We're going to pull back, we're going to go elsewhere. Globalization was one of the most disinflationary or deflationary impulses that the world has ever seen in a long, long time. And we're talking about taking that apart in a compressed time frame. And it, to me, it strains credulity to think that trying to rapidly move away from China and deglobalize and relocalize supply chains is not structurally inflationary at the consumer price level. And the bond markets are just blissfully ignorant of this because it's not right in front of their face. But to me, when you look at the geopolitical side of what's developing, I think we are moving to deglobalize, and that is structurally inflationary over time. The first part of your question, back then, we had a bunch of empty factories for that we were the world's biggest net creditor at that point. We had gold flowing here because we were on a gold standard and we were running surpluses with everybody. We were in the China position. So we had spare capacity in the middle of a depression. So the Fords of the world could shut down car production, switch it over to tank production, and away we go. So that's not true this time, number one. So that extends the time frame. Another point, I had a really interesting conversation a few years ago with an elderly gentleman who was in the Midwest and said that he was told by his parents, it was from a business family, that by the late 1930s, some of the industrial tycoons of the time throughout the Midwest were starting to buy up land to prepare for new factories, which at the middle of a depression, at the tail end of the U.S. depression, is a really odd thing to do. And what his parents told him was that some of these tycoons were getting the tap on the shoulder, if you will, that, look, there might be a war. And if there's a war, we're going to need to build more factories. And if you buy that piece of land and this piece of land and put a factory there, if there's the war. So there was, the point being, there was some lead time there that didn't make the history books in terms of how fast we ramped up. I don't know that we're doing that again. And I think this simplest way to answer it really is twofold. Number one, if you look at a chart we sent the clients last year, that the biggest container ports in the world, 7 out of 10 of them are in China. And so, and when you look at the amount of containers that through, this is just, you know, 7 of the top 10. It's not weighted. And so when you look at of the top 10, the weighted amount, it's all in China. And so you would need to move the equivalent of 7 plus of the 10 biggest ports in terms of capacity, container shipping capacity, throughput, plus all of the related supply chain, factory, infrastructure, logistics, and move it somewhere else. And that took China 20 years to do, 20 years plus. And the Chinese did it faster than anybody in history. And so when I bring this up to friends of mine that are execs in the international freight forwarding business and have grown up right alongside Chimerica, as some people have called it, this trade deal, this trade arrangement, I ask them, how long would it take? And they say 5 years at the absolute minimum, but you're probably talking decades plus, even under, maybe you could compress that under a Manhattan Project type of wartime footing. But again, that then gets us back to who's going to finance that. And the answer is the Fed's going to finance that. And by extension, the dollar is going to finance that.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I'm guessing we had a lot fewer regulations that strangle business back in the late 1930s than we do now. And I know one thing is for sure, is that government spending as a percentage of GDP was maybe 10% prior to the 1930s. I'm not sure what it was 1940s. Obviously, it went up substantially. But it was nowhere near what it is today. I just read a statistic that prior to COVID, it was about 40%. Now it's 50%. So the government spends 50%. They're responsible for 50% of GDP.
Let me see. Call it 22 trillion GDP and a little short of 4.5 of federal spending on the official line items. I don't know if there's off balance sheet stuff, but
that's state and local.
Oh, state local. Oh, I see. Yeah. Then you'd have to lump that on. So yeah, I was just citing federal numbers, and the federal numbers today are where we were near peak during World War II. So we're coming into this period of time when we in theory would need to spend like World War II to make this work. Like we're already in World War II.
Yeah, but my point is prior to trying to bring all these supply chains back to the United States, one, you have a massive amount of regulations compared to what we have.
Yep.
Like how do you navigate that as an entrepreneur to just build a factory? I mean, good luck with that. And especially if we get Biden or the left in office. I mean, think of the environmental hurdles that you're going to have to go through just to make masks or whatever you want to do. The energy, the green movement, I'm not saying that's good or bad, but that's definitely going to play into it. Where in China or the United States back in the 1940s, you just flip a switch. And you just make it happen. But also the private sector is such a smaller percentage of the overall economy that how do you burden that with bringing all those supply chains back? It's a lot harder to do when it's only 50% of GDP compared to, let's say, 90% of GDP, just taking it to an extreme.
No, I think that's exactly right. And then I would further add to that line of thinking that corporate debt's at all-time highs. And they went and borrowed a bunch of money to buy back stock to pay their execs. And so they're already levered. So they don't have the capital structure to do this. And then I go back to my initial point too of net national savings as a percent of gross national income. The US doesn't have the private sector balance sheet. No one has the money to finance this either. So it's not like even if the corporations had the balance sheet to issue the bonds, which they don't, the US private sector doesn't have the balance sheet to buy the bonds. And so it all keeps coming back to the same thing, which is the Fed will have to print it and the dollar will take the hit.
Yeah. Do you think the Fed put has expired? Now I'm talking just about the stock market.
I think it has. I don't think it's expired in the long run. I think tactically, when you look at what the Fed has said in the last, 4 weeks in terms of wanting, Powell said something about wanting markets to price risk appropriately. I think they would love to see some of the froth taken out of the markets. I think they are probably a bit concerned that they're breaking markets, which they are. They should be because they are.
I remember going back to middle of March. Remember the Fed was supposed to meet on a Wednesday and that emergency meeting on a Sunday where they dropped the interest rate by 100 basis points and the market just blew it off. It went up for like 3 hours and completely tanked. Was down by 1,000 points or whatever. And if my memory serves me right, the market really didn't start to go back up until the government came in and said, okay, we're going to do a fiscal stimulus package. So what I'm referring to is maybe the market back then, and I know Townsend's talked about this a lot, I got to give him the credit, where the Fed put in the mind of the market has expired, but it's been replaced by a government or a fiscal put, in which case that would be far more inflationary, because when the government spends the money, it directly increases M2 money supply, or if the Fed increases the bank reserves, it doesn't necessarily directly increase M2.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think the market is coming to the realization that MMT was basically begun 3 months ago, which is that fiscal put is there and that the Fed put will be there to keep rates at politically expedient levels. And whatever that means, the Fed has to buy. I mean, I think when you look at the charts, it looks like some sort of yield curve control has effectively been put in place, even though they say they're still evaluating it. It looks like there is some sort of like it's already effectively in place. And I think the market's also looking through the inevitability that you sort of know where what the U.S. government can afford in terms of interest rates relative to the rest of the budget before things start to spiral. And you can sort of you understand that with the dollar where it is, foreign demand is not where it needs to be for treasuries. And you solve for X, and X is the Fed. And whatever X needs to be is what the Fed will do. And I think that's what we're seeing in markets to a certain degree in terms of what the Fed's doing. And I think what the Fed did with on the corporate side 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, whenever that was, which seemed pretty preemptive in terms of seemingly increasing what they were doing. I think that caught a lot of people by surprise, myself included, that, boy, I thought that they would have to, after they had said, we want markets to price risk, as long as markets decide to price risk where we think risk should be.
Like zero.
Yeah, right. So you go, okay. And I think that's a little bit of what, where the market is right now is they're just, it's almost like it's testing the Fed is to say, okay, go ahead, raise rates. Go ahead, really pull back on, we dare you. Because they've got one, to me, they're not out of bullets on the downside, as we saw. Everyone said they were going into this, they were on down, you know, they were out of bullets. And I said, they're not out of bullets. They can grow the balance sheet to infinity if they want. They're not going to grow the balance sheet to infinity. Well, they grew it at a $34 trillion annual rate for a month and a half. And that was... $34 trillion is pretty close to infinity.
I think Buzz Lightyear would agree, Luke.
Yeah, if you don't believe me, start counting. Let me know when you get there, right?
Yeah, exactly. All right, I wanted to touch base just briefly on the swap lines. I did a video on that the other day, and it seems very difficult for the foreign banks to get the liquidity. Let's just say that the private sector needs it in Japan. And I just kind of did some research on how the swap lines are actually set up. But let's use the BOJ as an example, that they have an account with the Fed, and the Fed just credits their account. The BOJ does the same thing at the Fed. But then the Japanese bank, in this case, would have to access that credit line through an intermediary in the United States. And then they'd use that to for balance sheet capacity, dollar balance sheet capacity, to lend to XYZ Japanese corporate. But they're still on the hook, and the BOJ is still on the hook if the corporate goes bust. So if there's not a liquidity issue, if there's an insolvency issue from the standpoint of that corporation just isn't getting the dollar cash flow they need, then the way I saw it, the banks won't lend to them regardless if there's dollar need or not. And the central bank might not, because they're on the hook with the Fed, because that's technically a loan that they have to play back. So I'm making a short story long here, but then I tried to think through, okay, well, how does the Fed, if they want the dollar to go down a bit, how would the Fed get the money into the hands of the people that needed it? Or how, would they, and I know on the Fed's website, they said that maybe, my memory serves me right, like three or four times in the last 20 years, the New York Fed, the trading desk, has used dollars, sold them into the market to buy foreign currencies just to manipulate it a bit. I think the last time they did that was with the yen in the late 90s or maybe early 2000s. So I was thinking, okay, does the Fed print up the dollars? So there, you know, you got more bank reserves there, more liabilities, and then they're using those to buy FX, or they're buying foreign currencies. That goes on to the asset side. That's what they're doing to lower the dollar. But then I thought, well, if the dollar goes too low and it gets out of control, then the Fed really, other than what they just buy, they have almost no FX reserves. So I guess the two-part question is, number one, how do you see that transfer mechanism? If you're in charge of the Fed or the trading desk and you've got to lower the dollar, the DXY, how do you do it? And then if it goes too low, then how do you prop it up if you don't have the FX reserves? And you can't raise interest rates because you know it'll crush the economy.
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think, to me, when I think through how they could do it, I think the speech that Ben Bernanke gave back in November of 2002, it was a November 21st, I think, 2002, famous speech, deflation, making sure it doesn't happen here. It was, and no one knew it at the time, but it ended up being a really great roadmap for everything the Fed would do in the 08 crisis. And you know, a number of people have laid that out. And it's interesting to me how few commentators read all the way through. And I think they all read all the way through, but they just don't get to these last two parts that Bernanke said, which is that historically the dollar has been the purview of Treasury, that historically the Fed does monetary and the dollar is dollar policy is set by Treasury, not the Fed. And he said, with that said, moves to weaken the dollar are nowhere on the horizon. But if we wanted to, here's what we could do. And the first thing he said is we could go out and we could buy foreign sovereign debt, print dollars, buy foreign sovereign debt. And so that's the first answer to the question, I would say. Okay. And I don't think that needs a change or a change of the charter. And I think that's ultimately not that different from what you were just describing before of what's on the New York Fed's website in terms of what they did. And it's basically a currency intervention. And I think that would need to come from Treasury. Hey, Fed, print up money. We want the dollar lower, get it there. And so you could do that. The other thing Bernanke talks about is devaluing the dollar against gold as happened during the 30s. Now, it's a bit of an apples and oranges situation because obviously gold, we were on a gold standard then, and so it was a devaluation against gold at a time when it was on a gold standard. But I think the Fed could also do that. If you look at the New York Fed's website, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, they have a wide mandate to make markets function and foreign currencies, bonds, and gold. It says specifically and gold. And so if the Fed really wanted the dollar down, they could come out and say, hey, gold is now 3,000, 3,100 offered, 3,000 bid. And if we woke up on a Monday or came in on a Sunday night and gold was 3,100 bid by the Fed. At 3,000 bid by the Fed, boy, the dollar's probably down that next day.
Doesn't that create a feedback loop, though? If you're holding dollars as a foreigner, you want to get rid of them, it's a hot potato, and then it just keeps going down, and then how does the Fed prop it back up? I mean, let's just say the DXY drops to 60 or whatever the Fed would consider too low to where it's not good, then how do they prop it back up?
You could probably do it just by selling what they bought, I guess, right, in terms of some of those assets. If they had enough of them, you could start selling gold into the market at that point or lowering the bid on that. Okay. I think they really would be really reticent to do that because effectively you're saying the dollar is not the center of the system anymore. Now it's gold. And so I think that anything having to do with gold would be an absolute last resort. But I think doing something like that is possible. I think it's ultimately where this movie's going. But I think it's possible.
Okay. So talking about knock-on effects, one thing I wanted to address quickly here is a lot of people have thought about the Fed taking interest rates negative or Fed funds negative. And I don't know that they've thought about it from a professional standpoint, where if they take it too far negative, now all of a sudden, maybe the JGBs or other bonds in other countries look a little bit more attractive because of the yield. You kind of switch where the bonds for the United States, the treasuries, don't carry the highest interest rate. And so I don't know if people think that through, and it's tough for me to think it through because I'm not a pro. So what type of knock-on effects would happen if the Fed took interest rates negative, but further negative than the ECB and the Bank of Japan?
I don't think they can do that without explicit permission from the Treasury. And this ties back to the prior point where the dollar is the purview of Treasury. And so if the thing that few commentators talk about and with negative rates is, and this is the flip side is, well, we can do this because we're the dollar and we're the reserve currency. We hear that all the time. Well, the flip side of that is Japan can take rates negative because they're not the reserve currency. Europeans can take rates negative because they're not the reserve currency. The Americans can't do that because the Europeans don't have $7 to $10 trillion in EU bonds, European or Euro bonds sitting as FX reserves on balance sheets around the world. The Japanese don't have a bunch of JGBs, $7 to $10 trillion in JGBs sitting as FX reserves. Those are effectively treasuries acting as gold. And so if the Fed did that, my view is beyond a certain point, you would see basically $7 to $10 trillion of treasuries bidding for physical gold yielding zero. So the U.S., and that's why I say I think the Fed to take rates negative would need explicit permission to do so from the Treasury, because it would effectively be a move that ends the post-Bretton Woods dollar structure as global reserve currency. Because basically, why would you hold? You're basically reaching into the pockets, right? If those Treasury bonds are the savings accounts of all of the money that they all, basically Germany, Japan, all these nations sold stuff to the US, got paid dollars, reinvested the dollars in treasuries, those are their savings. And so now the United States would, by taking rates negative, would be essentially reaching into the pocket, reaching into the past and stealing the purchasing power. Basically, it's a debt jubilee because now the bonds are going to negatively amortize. And saying, well, you know what, we're just going to take that money out of your pocket. And the reaction to that is, no, that's okay. We're just going to show up and buy gold. And so I think you would see, if the Fed took rates negative, you would see $7 to $10 trillion bidding for gold in a fairly short compressed time frame. And just by way of comparison, $7 trillion, all the gold ever mined at current prices. Annually, gold mines produce $100-$120 billion a year. The mismatch is epic. And you know, the $7 trillion, people will say, well, don't worry, the $7 trillion going to $7 trillion in gold. $7 trillion of gold is in some pretty strong hands now. It's in I will happily let my gold go somewhere between $7,000 and $20,000 an ounce, but not before. And gold might go there, in which case, boom, you've basically converted $7 trillion in FX reserves into $7 trillion in gold reserves. And, but again, that's the end of the dollar. It's an end of the dollar's reserve status as structured since 1971, which is the dollar's the global reserve currency and the primary reserve asset is the U.S. Treasury bond. U.S. taking rates negative, the Fed taking rates negative would be telling the world the Treasury bond's role as primary reserve asset is over, replaced by gold. And to some extent, this has already been happening. As we've said a number of times, I think you and I have talked about before, over the last 7 years, global central banks have bought $200 billion in gold, and they've been, call it flat plus or minus what they've done with treasury bonds. So there's been a movement in this direction, but that movement hasn't been marked to market in terms of the price of gold. I think the Fed trying to taking rates negative would begin to mark that gold to market. And I think, like I said, I think the right price for gold at a minimum is, call it 4X and as much as, you know, 15X.
That's a great answer, Luke. I appreciate it. The main reason I wanted to ask the question is just so viewers and listeners know that it's not as simple as just the Fed taking rates negative. There's a lot more that goes into that that people just don't really think through. My next question, and I know we're getting short on time here, so I'll try to wrap it up, is did you read Chris Cole's paper on the dragon portfolio, the allegory of the hawk and serpent?
Loved it. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah. And so if and I'm really curious to get your opinion on this. I don't know if you've thought it through, but how would Luke Grohman go long volatility?
So Luke Grohman, I think it's you know, my grandfather's on my dad's side family moved here from a German speaking part of Europe, and so I think that's sort of the German in me tends to be a little conservative, and so for me, I think the best, easiest, cleanest way for the average investor to be long volatility is to own gold in your own pocket. You know, gold, bullion, coins, bars, whatever, and precious metals more broadly, but gold in particular, I think is the easiest. It's a low cost to carry. It's not complex. There's no counterparty risk. And furthermore, it benefits either way. If there's deflation or if there's inflation, if there's deflation, you might lose a little bit nominally in gold, but you're going to outperform virtually everything. And if you have inflation, and when I say inflation, I mean serious monetary debasement, you're going to do just fine with gold as well. And so to me, that's the easiest, cleanest way to play it. And everything else is, to some extent, you have to make a bet on which of these two outcomes we're going to get, this binary outcome of either a chaotic collapse of the system, in which case you want to own the VIX and equity volatility, and you want to own dollars because the stock market's going to crash to unimaginable lows and the dollar's going to rise to unimaginable highs. And gold will probably, like I said, maybe sell off a little lamely, but basically outperform everything but the dollar. Flip side is if the Fed does what I think the Fed's ultimately going to have to do, which is not just bail out the U.S., but also the entire euro dollar system, then you're going to be talking about you're not going to want to. I think equity volatility will probably not do a lot because equity markets could, you know, forget $30,000, $60,000, $100,000, $200,000 because of the amount of base money that will have to be created as the Fed tries to prevent this chain of debt deflation collapses. Basically, they take the U.S. to a big chunk of the U.S. credit market on their balance sheet. And then again, because we're the global reserve currency and the euro dollar system, takes some enormous chunk of the euro dollar system onto their balance sheet. And so you look at that and say, those are the, I think, the two legs where of what volatility, when you say, all right, if I want to be long volatility, we're looking at deflationary volatility, we're looking at inflationary volatility, and you got to make a bet. And gold does well on a relative basis, either way, low cost to carry, no counterparty risk. So for me, for the average investor, for myself, I think gold's the cleanest way to play it. Gold miners is a clean way to play it. Some other precious metals, some Bitcoin are all the cleanest, easiest ways for the average person to play what Chris is talking about, which I agree with. Like I said, I thought the paper was brilliant.
Is there a limit to the amount of treasuries the Fed can buy? And this kind of goes back to our earlier talking point when you're talking about the world reserve currency taking interest rates negative and what that would do to the savings account for all of these creditor nations that get a lot more dollars. Like, I'm just thinking if the Fed goes like Bank of Japan and buys 60% of the market, I mean, how does that affect repo? How does that affect the dollar funding markets? I mean, I'm just thinking through everything that Jeff Snyder talks about and there being a collateral issue. But if 60% or a majority of the bonds are just sitting kind of just doing nothing on the Fed's balance sheet, they're not in the system. I mean, how does that work? It just seems as though that could be catastrophic. And then do you get into this situation where the Treasury has to issue more debt just to, so there's enough collateral for the system, or do people just say, I'm done with the dollar? And I guess to tie that together, is there really a need for a global reserve currency?
I don't think there's a need for a global reserve currency. I think there's a need for a global neutral reserve asset because there will always be certain imbalances. They tend to be historically around energy, for example, right? When you look at how much oil the Saudis produced over time and what it cost, like they could own a lot of the world, right? So you need a neutral reserve asset if you want the U.S. to be able to compete with China. And that's a whole sort of separate discussion, but basically part of what we've done is hawk all of our manufacturing base as the cost really of having the treasury bond be the world's primary reserve asset. In terms of the mechanical flows of what you're talking about, of how much is too much, I think there's been an issue at times since 2012, 2013, where the Fed has done some of these reverse repo programs where they've gotten collateral back into the system for that use. And so I think there is a theoretical line in the sand where they can, again, this is a tricky thing where it's not a problem for the JGB market or the Europeans because they did not have their treasuries, their sovereign debt, basically as the underpinning to this entire collateral chain in the global financial system. So again, it's the global reserve currency has its benefits, but it also has its drawbacks. In terms of the collateral shortage, there's a number of different ways you could go about doing it. Like I said, there's sort of the Band-Aid fix where the Fed, practically speaking, becomes the biggest dealer out there. And right, so you're basically nationalizing markets. You have a Fed that is effectively setting credit rates. And that's, to some extent, already happened. And that's very inflationary for asset prices over time and on a lag for CPI. And I think we're a few years into that whole process where once the Fed's got the biggest balance sheet of the of collateral, they're basically setting markets, right? And there's been some, there were some moves in that direction with the move away from LIBOR into, I forget the acronym off the top of my head, but it was basically a Fed set rate because they're the biggest dealer. So that's the problem with that. Where I disagree with Jeff Snyder is I think we are much closer to a binary changing of the game than he does, which is, look, anything could serve as collateral. It just has to be big enough. And it has to be in the system already. And so, you know, if the Fed said, or if the financial system could agree that Beanie Babies were the new collateral or just as good as treasuries, gold, I think, is the one that really jumps off the page. And it's interesting when you have, so back in 2016, Ken Rogoff gave wrote a piece in Project Syndicate saying emerging markets should go for the gold was the title of the article. And he specifically said the risk-free asset shortage is a problem, and a way to rectify it is if emerging markets would begin moving their FX reserves out of sovereign debt into gold, because gold has no limit on its price. And so, yeah, right now you have a collateral shortage with gold at 1800. Gold at 18,000, probably don't have a collateral shortage.
Right.
But that's a political issue, right? That then gets into, well, the fact that the treasury market remains well bid is in part because you have to have treasuries to trade all this crap. It's a self-referential virtuous cycle that enforces the U.S. government's ability to run deficits without tiers. Well, it did through 3Q14, but the reality of it is that global central banks stopped growing their holdings of treasuries in 3Q14. And the reality of it is they can't buy more treasuries, even if they wanted to, because of where the dollar is. They're not generating the surpluses. Trade is not happening in sufficient quantities. And so you're moving in this direction of this binary switch where there's going to be, we don't have enough collateral, this whole system. And whether it happens organically, where the Fed just takes over all the markets and everybody just moves to gold because it's the only thing that's actually a real market, or whether it's done by government or central bank fiat, where they say, hey, in order to make collateral markets function, we're going to increase the supply of risk-free assets by increasing the price of gold to $5,000 or $10,000 an ounce. And that would suffice as doing it well. So there's a couple different ways, but the big picture is, as I look at the Basel III regulations and what that has done to basically forcing banks to collateralize more sovereign debt, or to own more sovereign debt, to me, it just seems a big push towards a neutral reserve asset, where basically gold is back at the center of the system as a floating risk-free asset.
All right, buddy. That was a great, concise answer to a pretty convoluted question. You pulled things together for me. I appreciate it. So, Luke, fantastic interview. I appreciate your time. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Absolutely. So they can check me out on Twitter. I've got an active feed there, and that is at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen. And if they're interested in research products, they can go to fftt-llc.com, frankfranktomtom-llc.com, and lots of information there about our different research product offerings available.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. I'd like to let everyone know I'm actually an affiliate for Luke Groman, a proud affiliate. So if you guys would like to support the channel, we'll put an affiliate link to one of his products in the description below. Luke, I appreciate it, and I cannot wait to do it again in the future.
Absolutely. Me neither, George. Thanks again so much for having me on. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com, or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.